Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. My name is Veronica Entwistle. I'm an intuitive and energy counselor, and I'm absolutely fascinated by the number of beings who are popping up with books, presentations, radio shows like this, global rapport with you and all kinds of people around the world talking about the fringes or the cutting edges of consciousness as human beings. What are the inventions going on? What's the art going on? Tonight's guest is a very, very exciting woman. She wrote a book called The Last Frontier, Julia Assant, PhD. And what she's doing is chronologing, and her research takes you back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, as well as very current in her own active mystical life. She chronologues the role of spirits and how and that's not all, but that's one of the things she does, and how when beings die, when you and I die, and sometimes we come back to talk to people, there are a lot of really good reasons for that. And she validates that over and over again, meaning that, here, I have a little story for you. My own mother had a lot of turbulence in herself. She was really sort of trapped all of my life with her. And after she left, and after she passed, she would come and give me a little lecture and give me some anger and so on because of how I was living my life as an intuitive and not being a practical school teacher or whatever. And I said to her at one point, okay, I'm not taking your calls anymore, Mom. Come back when you've grown up or something. So a number of years later, I'm in the kitchen puttering and cooking and all that. And who do I see but my mother, who comes in and she's this glowing, loving being. And 17 years after she passed, I said, Mom, is that you? It was an incredulous experience on my part. And she said, yes, and you have to know how proud I am of you. And she talked about the various things she realized that I was doing and how wonderful it was and how insightful and so on. She also got me to send messages to my father and my daughter and other people. And what she said was, finally, 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 I've broken through a huge limitation, a huge barrier to love that I had my whole life. And I want you to know that, and I want everyone else in the family to know. And you know something? I cried. My dad cried. My daughter cried when they each received their messages. But all of us, I guess, got a healing. All of us were unhooked and our inner selves changed radically. And now in Julia's book, she's got all kinds of stories like that. The Last Frontier, she's talking about validating the information that comes from many, many beings who have already crossed through the threshold. And her point of writing this book is exploring the afterlife and transforming, are you ready for this, our fear of death. And even though I work with people on the other side as a profession, I found by going through this book and by talking to Julia herself, I felt hugely expanded about the purpose of life and how life unfolds in so many different dimensional levels. So I hope you're going to enjoy her too. This little prelude is because we messed up the first part of the interview, so we're jumping right in. Here's Julia Assant. The collective is waking up, or more and more people are talking about life after death. More people are talking about how to die more gracefully. More people are talking about reincarnation. The Western world is full of reincarnation these days. Is there a collective, like, soul or spirit or personality that we're working toward as well? You know, we think about oneness and so on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And think about the first satellite shot of the planet from outer space.
What a jolt, eh, for everyone.
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. And that alone changed our consciousness. But even more was the telephone, the invention of a simple telephone, where for once you talked to a disembodied voice in some distant place.
Right.
And from there, technology kept developing, especially in communications, and I think that technology is training us, or it comes out of this deeper need to befriend our inner selves, which we've lost since the, you know, this heavy materialist age we've been in.
Yeah, I always think it's like training wheels for our consciousness, training wheels for our intuitive self, this phone thing.
I remember one fantastic psychic I went to many, many years ago who started telling me that I was going to enter into a period where I was constantly on a chat room. Computer. I said, never, that's never going to happen. I've never done a chat room in my life. It turned out that even she, who'd been trained by her parents, who are both professional psychics, she's always so accurate for me, even she confused the idea of a chat room with after-death communication.
Oh, wow, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, yeah. So these...
But that's it, we are in a chat room.
Allied perspectives and very allied perceptions. I'm sorry?
We are in a chat room, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think about
interaction.
The number of people that come through spontaneously. I'm sure you've experienced a lot of that. What would you say is the purpose? Or do you think there's just one purpose or many, many purposes?
Many, many. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are warnings. Spontaneous encounters have saved lives. Sometimes they've even left imprints on a person's body to get the person's body out of the way of a train or something.
Mm-hmm.
Very often assurances, or sometimes just to tell the person they've died. All kinds of different reasons. Remorse can be another strong drive, the need for reconciliation. But most of the time it's, don't worry, there is survival, I'm fine. And part of that message is, stop thinking of me on a deathbed.
Uh-huh.
You know, stop thinking of me that way. This is the way I am now. I'm whole, I'm alive, I'm in my prime. And abilities that are absolutely unknown in physical life. They're so expanded. So that's an important thing, especially for people dealing with those traumatic last moments, those memories that are so intrusive, to switch to where the person is now.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, and spontaneous encounters can often occur when a person has died unexpectedly, or in suicide, something of that sort, the need for contact, for explanation, for... seeking forgiveness is extremely strong, and these types of immediate after-death communications can be incredibly vivid, knock your socks off vivid. You know, you can feel it, like a tingling all over your body. The electrical energy is really present.
Oh, it's so exciting. When I do my work as an intuitive, I used to reject the idea of having too many spirits come, because I felt like I was being... hokey or whatever, you know, and like you, I'm pretty intelligent. But I learned through the years to immediately work with them, because there was always something, it seems like, in my work anyway, and I know that we all have different sort of specialties, but people wanted to be unhooked. And I often think it's so reincarnation-wise, we don't have to cart the same old drama reactive stuff with us. What do you think of that?
I totally agree. In fact, all the research and my own observations point to that there's no karmic debt.
Oh, really?
No,
now that's
there's
good.
There's no tallying. There's no dragging from one life to the other. It can't be. In order to have karmic debt, you have to have a time sequence. And in those inner dimensions where all of these things are spawned, time is simultaneous. That's one reason why we know that. But the other is these great researchers like Wambach and Ian Stevenson, who worked for decades on incarnation and interrogating people, or just making really careful, astute, academic observations. Stevenson was from the University of Virginia. There's no evidence of karmic debt. It's all about choice. It's all about wanting to come back to be with a certain person or whatever.
Really? Well, so let's go back to our discussion about reincarnation and that fellow who chained somebody under the table. That, just for an example, doesn't that kind of imply having a real knot of reaction left in the subconscious that could be undone? Is that not karmic debt? That's how I would have interpreted it.
Well, you could, but karmic debt means payoff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, karmic debt means if you're good in one life, you have a better life next time, or if you're bad in one life, you have a worse life next time. It supports hierarchical social structures, as in India.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of Gustav, this 11th century or medieval incarnation that two people remembered, this was a life when he was ready to deal with it or wanted to deal with it. There must have been others in between.
So he just had snags.
Maybe nothing happened.
Snags, energy snags that kept him acting out from that level. Is that what you call it, or?
Yeah, maybe something that he needed to resolve inwardly. Yeah, and that can happen. I mean, you are in communication with all your incarnations, and by the way, you can have incarnations at the same time you're having your present life, and you had future ones too. They're all happening at the same time, and certainly they influence you. But so does mass consciousness, so does the weather. But it doesn't mean that the weather is something about karmic debt.
Well, that makes sense, actually. When I was little, I used to look out at the stars at night because I never did sleep very well. A lot of us intuitives don't, really. And I always knew there was somebody out there in the star out there who missed me a lot, and I missed her.
Wow.
And I really feel like that was real. Have you had a section of your work that discusses that kind of thing? Because that's like, that must be the concurrent reality thing or something, eh?
Yeah, the simultaneous lives, yeah. I'm not sure I wrote this one in The Last Frontier, but from very early on, I was born on the East Coast, and I had communication with a farmer woman who must have been 30, 40 years older than I. And I knew of her existence, and she knew of mine. And there was a sense of sort of internal letter writing to each other.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember in my teens when she died. I just knew she had died.
But do you never met her on the physical?
No.
How
never
fascinating,
met her on the physical.
Hey?
But also at the same time, a woman came to me for a past life reading, and I couldn't do it. The only time really I've ever turned someone away, because all of her past lives were the same as mine.
Oh, you're kidding.
And she and I were confused on the streets. People would call her my name, and I would be called her name. We eventually became friends. Many years before I ever met her, I had a memory of a future incarnation. Very clear, it was real communication. From about 200 years from now, a guy named Bernard, who's a communications expert, who thought I was a real dimwit, and he said, "Oh, Julia, glad you finally figured it out." And so I put all that away, and it was maybe 20 years later where this incarnation of me, and I'm certainly an incarnation of her, came to me and said, "I just had a contact with a future life." And I sort of yawned and said, yeah, okay, tell me about it. And she said, "His name is Bernard."
And you went, "Oh my gosh."
Yeah. And we have been the same person, or at least say share the exact same memories, but we've also been married. We've been siblings. And so this is a kind of very close relationship, a kind of really tight constellation. But
do you think that's part of the same soul? Are you like?
Oh, yeah, we are. We are the same soul, yeah, absolutely. We're different aspects. Not always can all that you want to do or all the energies that you have be put into one body.
So what is a soul? What is a soul, Julia?
What is a soul?
Yeah, come on. In 10 words. No, I'm teasing you.
Well, I generally don't like the term. I mean, I like the term consciousness because it seems to have less borders than the soul. The soul we sort of think of as sort of a sphere of white light or something. But I have given in to the old term of the oversoul. It's just too beautiful. And I think we all are sort of created from that. And share in that, and in the afterlife state, we do have our personalities, but they keep expanding until they absorb all that memory, forward and backwards, and then even more memory from humanity, more and more. And I think really that is what the being of light is this expanded oversoul that knows who you are so intimately.
And you're saying,
wow.
So families, do we come together over and over again? Are we, I know I'm acting like it's we're not all present at the same time, but what I mean is our family groupings, do we stay together for infinity?
I can't answer for that. I don't know about infinity or everybody's experience. It's certainly not, I would be comfortable saying that no, there's some that just come in, you know, you might have somebody, like a child, die because a child in the family just doesn't like this kind of reality, this kind of experiment, and not come back.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll just get out. Say, that's enough. I've had, you know, 3 years of this. I don't want any more. This is not my thing.
So you have you have a lot of choice then about, it's like when we talked about it initially, that it's infinite possibility. I mean, what happens when you die is different for everyone by choice of culture, right?
Yeah, and personal expectations, state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the best thing you can do is to learn about the afterlife, so that everybody's more liberated during the dying process. Resolution takes place. Unfinished business gets finished. Discussion about what happens when the dying person is gone can occur. All of these kinds of things are greatly liberating to the living and to the dying.
Hmm.
So that everyone's emotionally free to participate in something that really, if we look at dying, it is totally miraculous. And it's an enormously creative act. One is not a victim of death. It's something one does.
So the bottom line, it's your choice in many cases, right?
Yeah. And we know that if there's more, if the reconciliation is made and death is accepted, and you know, God knows our culture fights death tooth and nail, which is ridiculous. It's a natural process.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost no pain, and death becomes very peaceful.
Hmm.
It sort of opens a threshold, and everyone around the deathbed experiences it.
Hmm.
And I think even when it's not so peaceful, most people have a story in their family of a miraculous-style death, you know, events that occurred that are just are too outrageous to be considered normal coincidence.
I love the idea of being able to just, when it's time just to move through. I always fantasize that I'm going to learn how to do that, where you just move through.
Absolutely, and mm-hmm. I do workshops on that.
Oh, you do? Oh, I'm coming.
Well, I do. It's a workshop called Living Your Death.
Ah.
And what I do is to take people through a bad past life first, so they get a little of that fear of death out of the way.
Okay.
Then a good past life, then a future life. And it's amazing how quickly people can do a future life death. And then most of the concentration is on the death in this life.
Oh, wow.
And so from the deathbed, they get to look back on their lives and see where they've held back, where fear stopped them, you know, where they didn't use their abilities or didn't live up to their own idea of what their lives should have been. It's really quite interesting what people come up with.
Hmm.
And, I would say in all cases so far, they do experience leaving the body, looking down on it, seeing the whole life as one sort of blurb, because
mm-hmm.
after all, it is just a tiny flash in the face of eternity,
mm-hmm.
and floating off into a kind of a peaceful light.
Nice.
And then things really start to pick up after
uh-huh.
that period.
Oh wow, that's wonderful. So we'll stay in touch about that, because it's interesting. I got your book in the mail so that I could interview you, and I had been saying I want to learn more about death. And so here
really?
You are, yes. And
here we are. Yeah.
Pops into the mail. So what about ETs and all that? Do you see that we're all in the same flow? What I mean is, are they just part of the same structure?
Yes. I mean...
Or there isn't a structure, consciousness flow.
I guess. It's just the non-physical dimensions. That's what we're calling ETs.
Mm.
You know... I'm not so sure about the physicalization of a lot of these sightings. I know that for myself, I've been able to ask for their presence to appear, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's not just some kind of fuel-powered spacecraft.
And do you ask for the presence of, and this is another ethical question, which I loved in your book, was asking for the presence of someone who has been deceased is in some religion, some spiritual tenets, considered taboo or interfering with God's work, right?
Yeah, and as you know, it's very strong in Catholicism.
Were you Catholic?
Yeah. Another thing we have in common.
Yeah. Well, when my first husband died, I was only 32, and when he would show up, I'd say, "Go to the light, go to the light," and I didn't.
Right.
Because I felt like I was
training.
Yeah, holding him back, and he couldn't fly, and all that sort of thing. But
that's Hindu twist, Hindu tradition too. Any tradition where there's this idea that you proceed immediately to the source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
What's the rush?
Well,
what is the rush?
And what is the source? Is it not around all the time?
Yes, exactly, Veronica. Exactly.
Yeah, it's so amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I have so many places to go with you.
Targets we have to get to, something other than what we are. And, I just don't agree with any of that. I think it's all about expansion and inclusion, not abandoning your lower self to, for a higher self. I just don't, that whole paradigm, speaking of paradigm shifts, is to me nonsensical.
Yeah.
And it degrades us. It degrades the human condition.
Well, I feel sometimes that we're kept in this kind of cage of sort of ignorance, and we're trying to break out. Is that not what your work is providing for us?
I'm hoping. And the point is to look at the evidence, abandon old thought forms, abandon this sort of Darwinistic idea of spiritual evolution. Let go of that stuff and see what the material is telling you. There's tens of thousands of after-death communications and near-death experiences. Look at them. Look at how they operate and start to tease out what part of it is just social production, of mass consciousness type thing or individual consciousness type thing. See where the differences are and get to work.
Yeah.
Do the analysis, add to the data, and see what we've got.
Well, do you
not superimpose old ideas?
Well, you're such a good researcher. Do you research through the beings that do you call forth people from the other side? Is what I'm asking, really?
Oh, sure. Like, that's the main part of my message. I think is being able to create an afterlife encounter when you want one, not just to be passive. I think if we can do that. And I'm sure we will be able to. In a few centuries, it'll be quite common. Your next door neighbor will say, "Your dead Uncle Harry says he's going to be around on Tuesday, so you stay tuned to get in touch." and I can imagine humanity living this way.
Mm-hmm.
They did before the Judaic reforms in Mesopotamia and in Egypt. There were ancestral shrines, there were letters to the dead, there were all kinds of techniques for contact or dream contact. Interaction was quite common. In fact, dead family members in Mesopotamia were buried in the house.
Hmm.
So there wasn't this sense of disconnection and pushing it away that we have now. Not at all.
Well, when you look at the Buddhist or the Lamas and so on, and they literally seek out the next incarnation.
Right.
Which
right.
is a
That's
slightly
really
different.
Really conscious.
Yeah. Can we do that?
And a great part of the training is toward conscious death.
Hmm.
Great part of it.
So would you also, for example, say, I'd like to talk with Edgar Cayce and be able to bring him through, that sort of thing?
I think in time we can do that. I think in time we can probably make fabulous contact with scientists and historians and artists, and it is potentially the greatest resource that could ever exist.
Mm-hmm.
But for right now, we have to operate from individual need, because it's that need that calls in the people on the other side.
Do you think
that... It's also true, I think as an intuitive, that when you are working with someone, mm-hmm. you respond to that person's need. That's what brings that emotional energy through and makes things happen.
Well, that's true, because it's awfully convenient, but I often think there's a certain light around us which kind of calls them in or harmonizes with them, like somebody rings a bell.
Yes, exactly. So kind of resonance. Absolutely.
It's really interesting, isn't it? So we go back to the Egyptian times, for example, and I think of it as being, I know certain things intellectually, but I think of it intuitively as being kind of a time of the fusion of beings, sons of God and the sons of man. I always think that's kind of like different dimensions infusing some of the people. Does that make sense? And then I think, is some of it just imprint? Are we just picking up, or were they just picking up on blobs of conscious energy, resonances of consciousness that happen to be floating around in the ethers?
The Egypt that we know of from archaeology and from history is not that Egypt.
Oh, okay.
And I'm a Mesopotamist more than I have had to do Egyptology as well, but we're looking at cultures that both sort of bloomed at the same time. You know, there's a big debate on which one had the first written language.
Oh, really?
And you have to go much further back in order to start to discover how, I would say, maybe archetypes worked in order to change the consciousness of humanity. So, but the Egypt that we know is one where the afterlife in very early stages was, survival was really reserved for the pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
And it became more democratic. But also then later on, it started to have a moral attachment, that people who had a certain moral integrity were the ones who survived. And this was a very bad downturn.
Hmm.
Because earlier systems of thought about the afterlife admitted everyone, as do all traditional societies. Everyone is allowed to have survival after death. Everyone goes to more or less the same so-called place.
Hmm.
Moral systems became stronger and stronger later on, around 5th, 7th, 5th century B.C., you have the invention of sin. This was not there before.
Hmm.
All these ideas that we have of these things being forever and from the beginning are just not true. You can historically track them.
Hmm.
So my thing is, you know, I'd love to see us get back to more traditional way of looking at the afterlife, where everybody can be embraced, everybody goes to it.
Well, I guess when I think of it, I think they had and this is not as a researcher as you are, but I just thought that they had the ability to move energy and do amazingly empowering things, at least the pharaohs or some of the top people. The energy work, that's what I think.
I think there was tremendous amount of training in that area.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where you went for that kind of training, was in Egypt.
Yes. So that's more what
absolutely,
I was doing.
Yeah. And I am 100% certain at this point that Akhenaten, who was the father of Tutankhamun,
mm-hmm.
Created his whole new wave religion around a near-death experience. I'm absolutely certain of it, yeah.
Well, here's something that happens to me, and this might be happening to some of our listeners and probably to you. But, for example, when people bring up conversations to Akhenaten, I always shake all over and go into this really wild vibrational thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's something. That's why I asked about the imprint as well. Not just that, because I know a lot of different people with different connections to, for example, Egypt and Sirius and these other myths that go on, or these other concepts that go on. But when a person shakes like that in you know, talking about Akhenaten, who brought everything into the one God focus, did he not? He was really a groundbreaker.
The idea of a one God was not that there weren't other gods. It was even true with Jehovah.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that he was the only God. It was the only God you should honor.
Right, okay.
Or worship. There's
so he was a bit
difference.
Of a control guy then, huh?
Who?
Akhenaten, or?
No, I don't think so. I think you can tell from the images of him that he had some kind of illnesses.
Yeah, some thymus problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he had a near-death experience that was powerful, and he felt he had met the sun god, which is, you know, what the being of light would be.
Mm-hmm. And he probably had.
Yes, I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. Mm-hmm. We have no idea how often near-death experiences may have operated in the foundations of religions.
So near-death experiences are really a pivotal. You're talking about the soul being really consciousness, and near-death experience is something that really activates the power of the consciousness, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like a major conversion experience. It changes you electrically too, It changes your
It changes you electrically.
Pattern
I
of
love
consciousness.
That. I love that.
It's like an electric shock.
Huh.
A lot, and any kind of strong contact with the other side is capable of doing that. But let's not forget, too, that there are a substantial amount of not very positive near-death experiences as well.
Mm-hmm. Why is that, do you think?
I think all of them are subjective experiences. And they have to do, with expectation, with sense of guilt, fear, things of that sort.
So they're just an example of the variation of afterlife, then, is it?
Absolutely. But carrying certain similar features. But more than similar, I think you can find dissimilarities. And unfortunately, the research is not ready really to take on examination of the difference. I'm thinking of doing it myself at some point.
Well, have you had near-death experiences yourself?
I did, yes. Mm-hmm. It was not by any means my first spiritual experience as a child, by any means. And I did write about it in the first draft of the book, and it was so unspectacular that my editor cut it out.
You know what, going back to the past life regressions and so on, I was pretty fascinated, and we were just talking about the collective and the power and controlling the people and so on. I'm pretty fascinated that I think you said something like 70% of regressions take people into lives where they were pillaged and murdered and poverty struck and lived short, right?
No, not dramatic. Not murdered and all, not dramatic, but 70% were absolutely nothing. You know, so lower social economic levels and had no historical significance whatsoever. More or less the same sort of demographics we would have expected for the periods before the 21st and 20th century.
Wow.
So, you know, this notion of, you know, everybody being the pharaoh's daughter or a high priestess of Ur or whatever, this is not what we come up with past life experiences. This is not involving fantasy. I mean, if you were going to imagine yourself in a past life, why put yourself in a medieval hovel? But that's really what happens, you know. That's what happens. That's one of the reasons why these things are so genuine. The second one is when you go through these past life regressions and relive it, you have tremendous effects afterwards. I mean, there are changes occur. That's another way we know that there's something real about that past life. And the third, of course, is that the more recent ones can be historically tracked. I found my own past life person in a rural grave in England.
Oh, wow, really?
I was conducted by dreams and a very close dead friend of mine to find this woman. I knew her name from a regression, and I found her.
And how far back was it?
Not very far back, Victorian.
Oh, my.
But there are more spectacular ones. And again, Netherton writes about a woman, for instance, in Brazil, who like a brand came up on her arm with numbers. And she was talking about her death in a Nazi camp.
Wow.
And they sent this to the Holocaust Center in Jerusalem, just the number. And all the information she gave matched 100% with what the Holocaust Museum had archived.
Well, so, and didn't that number rise on her arm temporarily,
yes, like
as she
blistering.
Went?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that but it left, did it?
Yes, it does leave. I mean, this can happen too. I've worked with people in past life in regression, because it's not like past life, and it's not really regression either. Excuse the misnomer.
Yeah, I understand what
you're
saying.
But people going into childhood who were, you know, I've worked with people who were hung by ropes on the wrists in the cellar overnight as punishment. And when you're doing this stuff and reliving it, those wrist rope burns will come back. Not always, but they can.
Well, this is going to sound a little...
Cellular memory.
Yeah,
cellular
this is going to sound a little trivial, but my mom had a big scar on her lip. And when I was upset as a little girl, I would develop that.
Wow.
What does that mean, do you think? Is that just an example of how we're, I don't know, consciously connected?
Yeah.
What does that kind of connection mean?
I would call that cellular telepathy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, where you're picking up stuff from your mother, actually sharing it or carrying it for her. at a cellular level, and what this was on her lip, what that symbolized, its origins, its effect on her, is something that you helped her carry.
Hmm.
Telepathically.
So this is telepath and telepathy and empathy and all of those things. Do you have anything to say about that? Is that out of your, that's not necessarily in the last frontier, but it's a big subject these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. The one mind.
Yeah.
The one mind, yeah.
And how do we strengthen ourselves with it? It's pretty interesting, isn't it?
By noticing where it's already happening. That's one of the first things. And, you know, the second is always to get past the shame barriers so you can open up more. All the places we carry shame, they're where the blocks are.
Hmm. So let's take you back to finding your own path or your own incarnational burial place in the Victorian thing, Victorian
mm-hmm.
times. Did you feel a real affinity for that being?
Oh, yeah.
How did you feel?
Just prior to this trip in England, I was standing in my bedroom in my apartment in New York when I lived there, and I actually transformed into her. It reminds me a little bit of that moment, Cinderella, where, you know, she starts to see this dress forming around her.
Mm-hmm.
I became this woman, and my whole body structure felt different.
Hmm.
There was a rigor in my chest and a tightness where I held myself upright and all this kind of thing. It was a remarkable experience. And this is, again, a kind of a cellular memory.
Mm-hmm. It's an empathy, too,
Yeah. And then I started having after-death communication with some of the people I knew in that life. So that was, and they were still in, you know, using Victorian phraseology and whatever. It was quite a knockout.
Well, that's really exotic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, not particularly in past life therapy.
Uh-huh.
You really, I mean, you know, how different is that from this woman getting the Nazi camp tattoos on her arm? Not mm-hmm. really.
Not really.
Yeah.
So I've had experiences, and so have others, where somebody who seems to be dying all of a sudden shows up in your car and says he's not dying, and you know he is not on the other side. It's not afterlife communication, but in essence it is, isn't it?
Yep. I think, Veronica, you're one person who's going to understand this thoroughly. I think the whole idea of afterlife probably is something we have to redirect.
Because it's not after, is that what you're saying?
Yes. I knew you'd get that right away. It isn't, because there's, you know, I've had readings where I had two dead people show up and one preborn who's coming into this family. And what does that mean in terms of an afterlife? What dimensions are we talking about? And, you know, people who are in coma or with Alzheimer's or whatever also operate in those dimensions, and sometimes in the same way as a person who has actually passed operates. They appear the same way. They have similar energies. What are we talking about? We're just scratching the surface now.
So if we're talking to somebody who's got extreme Alzheimer's, you can be speaking with their conscious self.
Yep. Totally clear.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
this
in the
is so
book
exciting.
Do,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Isn't it? In the book, I relate this one incident where there was a man who had Alzheimer's for maybe... so severe anyway that he was unable to speak for the last 10 years of his life.
Okay.
A totally rotted brain. That's what the autopsy afterwards also confirmed. And just, there was a certain point where he started to look like he was failing, you know, really failing rapidly. And his two sons were there, ready to call 911 to get an emergency, get him to the hospital. And suddenly he breaks out of 10 years of silence and dementia and says, "Don't call 911. You just tell your mother I'm all right." And he dies.
Oh.
Now, how can that happen with a brain that is supposedly so destroyed?
That's a wonderful story. I mean, what it invigorates in me and probably in other listeners is that potential to actually communicate with these beings so that it's not such a dreadfully isolating sickness. Eh?
Absolutely. And also to help these people who are in coma.
Right.
know, just lying there, unable to get out because there's not enough stimulus.
And to have you ever seen the movie, the little television show called Saving Hope?
No, I haven't.
It's Canadian. It's one of those medical, you know, weekly shows, and the guy goes into a coma at the beginning, and then his experience is out of body in the hospital. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it was really wonderful. They pulled it off because they wanted to do some crap. But I think you're right. Huh?
Yeah, and it leads to the question, what are we saying or what are we talking about when we say something is dead? When does that happen?
Okay, so tell me about animals.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, are they in a different track than we are? Are we all just experiencing our animals along with us when we're, in quotes, dead?
I'm not sure I understood that.
Okay, so we have people communicating from the other side, and by choice and by experience and by sharing. And it's so with animals as well, is it not?
Yes, indeed. In fact, a really high percentage of spontaneous afterlife encounters are with animals, something in the area of 10 to 16%.
Really?
Yeah. And I do a lot of animal death assistance stuff where all of my animals die naturally, and we have, I've had tons of them. And recently, our poor 12-and-a-half-year-old chicken just died.
Aww.
And yeah, she was a beauty. So I watch them, you know, take them over the other side, and usually I have a setup for them, or something occurs, something happens, and I can stay with them for quite a long time. And then often one animal will introduce me or let me know what the other ones are doing.
Hmm.
Not always, because they don't always know.
So you're communicating with the animal's consciousness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of animals, and this is corroborated over and over again with from many afterlife encounter accounts, they go to a family member, even if they never knew that family member, if they were, the animal was adopted after these people died. And they do show up when people die. I had a cousin who had a terrific amount of cancer, and she knew that she couldn't take care of her dogs. She put her dogs down, and I think that killed her. You know, that was just on her conscience, so heavy. But her immediate afterlife communication to me was, they're alive, they're here, and I saw these dogs bounding toward her.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
And this is quite a common experience. Quite common.
So you're saying also that working with them and having a more natural depart, you tune into the animals, you get to know when they're ready, and then you help them pass, is that right? You help them release their body?
Almost invariably, there's somebody, you know, my father is very active, my dead father and other dead friends, you know, relatives, assist me. I mean, they will even say, leave her alone, don't take her to the vet, she'll be dead at 2:15 today. And that's exactly what happens.
Wow.
So now, I get tremendous assistance from them, and they're the ones who usually pick the animals up afterwards.
Just a sec, I'm getting confused here. When we're learning, I guess I want to say, all you're saying is teaching me that we can encourage people to die. We can encourage our animals to die. I don't mean just have them die out of choice. What I mean is without their own choice. But you're saying we can smooth that path and really teach people that they can just keep going, right?
Yes. To see death as actually a creative triumph.
Hmm.
You know, that when you're not, the psyche is no longer growing, no longer expressing. You know, it's time to move on. These mechanisms come into place and the transition is made. We know how to die. It's something not so much to encourage, but to understand, to honor.
That is something that we all do.
It's something that we all do and know how to do. And it's only humans who've got this terrible resistance and this fear, which is causing so much pain, so many complications, and has made a society that exploits this fear.
Wow.
We are exploited left and right by the fear of death.
I know, you know, it's funny.
Every industry, every institution does it now.
I know, and you are so inspiring. I'm going, why would we bother as free consciousness to come back into an exploited species or a controlled species or a fear-based
right.
species? Why would we
exactly.
bother?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think when you get out there and you have, and I'm sure you know exactly what I mean, and I'm sure you've been there so many times, you start to, you operating from what I call the psychology of immortality, from that perspective where you are looking at the human drama, it actually looks not just pathetic and sad, but sometimes terribly funny.
Well,
all this drama that we make, all of these problems that we make, it's part of a creative process, but we really could do a lot better.
Well, I think that you are inspiring that very consciousness in me, and I'm sure in many of our listeners.
I
hate to let you go because you've got so much wisdom and wit.
Veronica, thank you.
I just thank you so much for coming on to Paradigm Shifters and for doing your courageous work. I really am delighted with our conversation and my experience with you. Thank you.
Thanks for letting me on.
And, Julia, you better tell everybody how to get hold of you. I don't think it's that
hard. Oh, okay. Good idea. Website is really simple, www.juliaasante.com. And the spelling of that name is J-U-L-I-A. A-S-S as in Sam, A-N as in Nancy, T-E.
You have a wonderful...
JuliaAsante.com.
And you have a wonderful YouTube up there, which I enjoyed, but also for people who are listening, you have a lot of very interesting, like, small things and interesting things to read on your website. I thought it was very well done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. I hope you feel freer about, transitions on this planet. Thank you to Julia.
Well, I hope you got as much from Dr. Asante as I did, and I sure hope you'll peek through The Last Frontier. Oh my gosh, what an expansive book. And I noticed that she's talking about how to make contact. I think in like when you're having conversations with people and those conversations are elevating or releasing or prompt forgiveness and so on, there has to be a strong listening component, doesn't there? So the kind of listening where you actually vibrate to what the person is saying. And I feel this, that when you think you're seeing a spirit, listen, be quiet and listen. I often get them when I'm driving. And what she says is a lot of the contacts that are made that are really good are when you're very busy doing something that might be by rote, like when you're driving or you're chopping vegetables or, you know, something like that, and somebody starts speaking with you or someone shows up. And if you really listen, you'll get the vibration of their truth. I often teach my clients that if you're really, really angry with someone and they show up from the other side, you're better to vibrate your real anger, like I'm very angry with you and frustrated because you left me feeling this way, or you did this or that, or blah, blah. But just say, you know, what your real feeling is, because that person who's on the other side can really feel the vibration and they can emanate back a clearing. You see, if you get in step, it's like a dance. If you vibrationally get in step with one another, you can literally neutralize something that might have stayed in there and been a lifelong pattern. And yet you can help each other tremendously. I love that kind of work, and thank you to Dr. Asante. I am now much more vigorous about talking to spirits when they show up, and I certainly get a lot of visitations. You probably do too. You just don't always tune into them. So we're saying to you, tune in, and tune in again to Paradigm Shifters. My name is Veronica Entwistle, and any feedback on this, or also read some of my blogs on veronicaentwistle.com, or send me an email, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to interact with you about this subject, and that's the point of the blog, isn't it? So we'll talk soon. Thank you for listening, and many, many blessings.